Beverages. Some of my favorites include black tea, chai tea, vanilla chamomile tea, coffee, Earl Grey tea, green tea, hibiscus tea, hot chocolate jasmine tea, lemon balm tea, matcha tea, almond blossom oolong tea, peppermint tea, rooibos tea, water, and white tea. Serving size here is one glass, which is more than a cup, about 12 ounces. My daily recommendation is 5 servings a day. There are plenty of dietary guidelines for eating, but what about for drinking? The Beverage Guidance Panel was assembled to provide recommendations on the relative health and nutritional benefits and risks of various beverage categories. The panel included such heavyweights as Dr. Walter Willett, chair of the Nutrition Department at Harvard University School of Public Health, and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. The panel's nutrition experts ranked beverage categories on a 6-tier scale from best to worst. Unsurprisingly, soda ranked last. Whole milk, meanwhile, was grouped with beer, with a recommendation for 0 ounces a day. Their justification included concerns about links between milk and prostate cancer, as well as aggressive ovarian cancer, perhaps, quote, related to its well-documented effect on circulating concentrations of insulin-like growth factor 1, unquote. Tea and coffee, preferably without creamer or sweetener, tied as the number 2 healthiest beverage, second only to water, the top-ranked drink. Water. More than 2,000 years ago, Hippocrates said if we could give every individual the right amount of nourishment and exercise, not too little, not too much, we would have found the safest way to health. Water is the healthiest beverage to drink, but how much is too little and how much is too much? Water has been described as a neglected, underappreciated, and under-researched subject. But many of the studies extolling the need for proper hydration have been funded by the bottled water industry. Turns out the oft-quoted drink at least 8 glasses of water a day recommendation actually has little underpinning scientific evidence. The 8-a-day recommendation can be traced back to a 1921 paper in which the author measured his own urine and sweat output and determined he lost about 3% of his body weight in water a day, which comes out to be about 8 cups. Subsequently, for the longest time, water requirement guidelines for humanity were based on just one person's urine and sweat measurements. But now there's actually extensive evidence suggesting that not drinking enough water may be associated with a variety of problems, including falls and fractures, heat stroke, heart disease, lung disorders, kidney disease, kidney stones, bladder and colon cancer, urinary tract infections, constipation, dry eye disease, cavities, decreased immune function, and cataract formation. The problem with many of these studies, though, is that low water intake is also associated with several unhealthy behaviors, including low fruit and vegetable intake, more fast food consumption, and even less shopping at farmers markets. And think about it. Who drinks lots of water? People who exercise a lot. So perhaps it's no wonder that heavy water drinkers have lower disease rates. Only large and expensive randomized trials could definitively settle these questions, but given that water cannot be patented, such trials seem unlikely. As a result, we're left with studies that just link disease with low water intake. But are people sick because they don't drink enough water, or are they not drinking enough because they're sick? There have been a few large prospective studies in which fluid intake was measured before disease developed. For example, a Harvard University study of nearly 48,000 men found that the risk of bladder cancer decreased by 7% for every extra daily cup of fluid consumed. A high intake of water, say 8 cups a day, may reduce the risk of bladder cancer by about 50%, potentially saving thousands of lives. Probably the best evidence we have for specific recommendations for how much water we should drink comes from the Adventist Health Study. 20,000 men and women were studied. Those who drank 5 or more glasses of water a day had about half the risk of dying from heart disease compared to those who drank 2 glasses or less daily. About half of the cohort consisted of vegetarians, so they're already getting extra water by eating more fruits and vegetables. As in the Harvard study, this protection remained even after controlling for other factors such as diet and exercise, suggesting that water indeed was the cause, perhaps by lowering blood viscosity, that is, by improving blood flow. If protection against cancer and heart disease isn't enough motivation, perhaps the prospect of being a better kisser will be. Brushing artificial skin against the lips of young women, researchers found that hydrated lips showed greater sensitivity to light touch. Based on the best evidence to date, authorities from Europe, the U.S. Institute of Medicine, and the World Health Organization recommend about 8 to 11 cups of water a day for women and 10 to 15 cups a day for men. And these recommendations include water from all sources, though not solely beverages. You get about 4 cups from the food you eat and the water your body actually produces on its own. So these guidelines roughly translate into a daily recommendation for drinking 4 to 7 cups of water for women and 6 to 11 cups for men, assuming only moderate physical activity at moderate ambient temperatures. You can also get water from all the other drinks you consume, including caffeinated beverages, with the exception of stronger alcoholic drinks like wines and spirits. Coffee, tea, and beer can leave you with more water than you started with, but wine actively dehydrates you. Note, though, in the cancer and heart disease studies I just mentioned, the health benefits were almost exclusively associated with increased consumption of water, not other beverages. And I've already addressed the problems with alcoholic drinks earlier. Bottom line, unless you have a condition like heart or kidney failure, or your physician otherwise advises you to restrict your fluid intake, I recommend you drink 5 glasses of tap water a day. I prefer tap not only because it's less economically and environmentally costly, but because it may have less chemical and microbial contamination than bottled water. Can drinking water make you smarter? Your brain is 75% water. When you become dehydrated, your brain actually shrinks. How might this affect brain function? Based on urine samples obtained from groups of 9 to 11-year-old kids in Los Angeles and Manhattan, nearly 2/3 of children may arrive at school in a state of mild dehydration, which may in turn negatively affect scholastic performance. If you take a group of school kids and randomly assign them to drink either 1 or 0 cups of water before taking a test, guess which group does significantly better? The group given the water. These results, the researchers conclude, suggest that, quote, even children in a state of mild dehydration, not induced by intentional water deprivation or by heat stress or living in a cold climate, can benefit from drinking more water and improve their cognitive performance, unquote. Your hydration status may also affect your mood. Restriction of fluid intake has been shown to increase sleepiness and fatigue, lower levels of vigor and alertness, and increased feelings of confusion. But as soon as study subjects were allowed to drink again, the deleterious effects on alertness, happiness, and clarity of thought are almost immediately reversed. Water absorption begins very rapidly, within 5 minutes from mouth to bloodstream, peaking around minute 20. Interestingly enough, cold water gets sucked into your body about 20% faster than body temperature water. How can you tell if you're dehydrated? Just ask your body. If you chug some water and pee most of it out soon after, that would be your body's way of saying it was all topped off. But if you drink a bunch of water and your body keeps most of it, then your tank was running low. Researchers used this concept to develop a formal dehydration assessment tool. Empty your bladder, chug 3 cups of water, and then see how much you pee an hour later. They determined that if you drink 3 cups and urinate less than 1 cup within that hour, there's a good chance you are dehydrated. But, you know, water can be so boring. Try adding fresh fruit or veggies, as they do in the fancy spas and upscale hotels. I like adding frozen strawberries in place of ice cubes. Sometimes I add a few drops of a potent juice concentrate like tart cherry or pomegranate. Cucumber slices, ginger shavings, a cinnamon stick, lavender, a mint leaf or two are also common refreshing additions. My latest favorite flavor fusions involve mixing tangerine slices and fresh basil, or frozen blackberries and fresh sage. Or bubbles. One of my colleagues at work has that soda stream on his desk, and he makes his own sparkling water for about 25 cents a cup. In addition to making water more interesting, carbonation may also help relieve gastrointestinal symptoms. A randomized trial of the effects of sparkling versus still water found that drinking carbonated water may improve symptoms of constipation and dyspepsia, including bloating and nausea. What if you took water and added beans or greens, that is, coffee beans or tea leaves? Wouldn't you get all the water you need plus a bonus of additional nutrients? A cup of black coffee, tea, or herbal tea only has 2 calories, potentially offering nutrition at little caloric cost. Think of healthy beverages as the opposite of junk food. Junk food offers calories with scarce nutrition, whereas healthy beverages offer nutrition with scarce calories. But just how healthy are coffee and tea? I've already discussed the benefits of coffee for the liver, mind, and brain. What about overall longevity? Do people who drink coffee live longer lives than people who don't? The National Institutes of Health AARP Diet and Health Study, the largest ever prospective study conducted on diet and health, put that question to the test. Yes, drinking lots of coffee is associated with a longer life, but the effect is relatively modest. People who drank 6 or more cups a day had a 10-15% lower mortality rate due to fewer deaths from heart disease, respiratory disease, stroke, injuries and accidents, diabetes, and infections. However, when the study looked at people under the age 55, the opposite effect was found. Drinking more than 6 cups of coffee daily was found to increase the risk of death. Hence, the researchers concluded, quote, "It may be appropriate to recommend that younger people, in particular, avoid heavy coffee consumption, meaning less than 28 cups per week or less than 4 cups in a typical day." The bottom line, based on all the best studies to date, is that coffee consumption may indeed be associated with a small reduction in mortality, on the order of 3% lower risk of premature death for each cup of coffee consumed daily. Don't worry, it's not wake up and smell the coffee, or don't wake up at all. The findings are less prescriptive than they are reassuring for those concerned about their coffee addiction. Coffee is not for everyone. For example, be careful if you have gastroesophageal reflux disease, right, GERD. While a population study found no link between coffee consumption and subjective symptoms of GERD, such as heartburn and regurgitation, scientists who actually stuck tubes down people's throats to measure their pH found that coffee does seem to induce significant acid reflux, whereas tea does not. Caffeine does not appear to be the culprit, since caffeinated water doesn't cause a problem. However, the coffee decaffeination process seems to reduce the level of whichever compounds are responsible, since decaf coffee appears to cause less reflux. The researchers advise that people who suffer from GERD should consider switching to decaf, or even better, drink tea instead. Daily coffee consumption is also associated with a slightly increased risk of bone fractures among women, but interestingly, a decreased fracture risk among men. However, no association was found between coffee and hip fracture risk. Conversely, tea may reduce hip fracture risk, but appears to have no significant effect on fracture risk in general. This is an important distinction because hip fractures are associated with a shortened lifespan more than other types of bone fractures. People with glaucoma, or even with merely a family history of glaucoma, may also want to stay away from caffeinated coffee. Coffee intake is associated with urinary incontinence in both men and women, and there are case reports of individuals with epilepsy having fewer seizures after laying off coffee, so avoiding it is certainly worth a try for people with seizure disorders. Finally, it almost goes without saying that people who have trouble sleeping might not want to drink too much coffee. Just a single cup at night can cause a significant deterioration in sleep quality. The mystery of why some studies showed that coffee consumption increased cholesterol and others did not was solved when it was discovered that the cholesterol-raising compound thought to be responsible was fat-soluble. The culprit compound, cafestol, is found in the oils of coffee beans that become trapped in the paper filter, so drip coffee doesn't raise cholesterol as much as French press, boiled, or Turkish kind of mud-style coffee. Neither the degree of roasting nor decaffeination appears to make a difference, though Robusta beans have less cafestol than Arabica beans. If you don't have optimal cholesterol levels, you should consider sticking to filtered coffee or using instant coffee, which also lacks these compounds. If these tweaks don't help, consider eliminating coffee completely, as even paper-filtered coffee may raise cholesterol levels a small amount. We used to think caffeine might increase the risk of an irregular heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation, but this was based on anecdotal case reports involving the acute ingestion of very large quantities of caffeine, including a case blamed in part on a woman's chocolate intake, quote-unquote, abuse. As a result, the erroneous notion that caffeine ingestion may trigger abnormal heart rhythms became common knowledge, an assumption that led to changes in medical practice. More recently, however, actual studies were performed that revealed caffeine intake does not appear to increase the risk of atrial fibrillation after all. Moreover, low-dose caffeine, which was defined as drinking fewer than 6 cups of coffee a day, may even have a protective effect on heart rhythm. Moderate caffeine consumption in healthy, non-pregnant adults is not only safe, but has been found to increase energy and alertness and enhance physical, motor, and cognitive performance. Despite these benefits, one medical journal editorialized that doctors should temper any message that suggests caffeine is beneficial, given the proliferation of energy drinks that contain massive quantities of caffeine. Indeed, drinking a dozen highly caffeinated energy drinks within a few hours could cause a lethal caffeine overdose. That said, drinking a few cups of coffee a day may actually extend your life a bit and even has the potential to slightly lower your overall cancer risk. I cannot recommend drinking coffee, though. Why? Because every cup of coffee is a lost opportunity to drink a potentially even healthier beverage, a cup of green tea. Tea. Green, black, and white teas are all made from the leaves of the same evergreen shrub. Herbal tea, on the other hand, involves pouring hot water over any plant in the world other than the tea plant. What's so special about the tea bush? Phytonutrients exclusive to the tea plant appear so powerful that they can reverse disease even when merely applied to the skin. For example, the topical application of green tea in ointment form on genital warts results in astounding 100% clearance in more than half the patients tested. It's no wonder that this wonder treatment is now officially incorporated into the Centers for Disease Control STD treatment guidelines. There was even a remarkable case report of a woman whose skin cancers were apparently stopped with topical green tea application. If green tea can do that for the outside of your body, what might it be doing internally? I already discussed the role green tea may play in breast cancer prevention. Drinking tea may protect against gynecological malignancies as well, such as ovarian cancer and endometrial cancer, as well as lower your cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, and body fat. It may protect the brain from both cognitive decline and stroke. Tea consumption is also associated with decreased risk of diabetes, tooth loss, and up to half the risk of dying from pneumonia. Those who suffer from seasonal allergies may also benefit from drinking tea. Randomized trials have shown that drinking about 3 cups of Japanese Benefuki green tea per day starting 6 to 10 weeks before pollen season significantly reduces allergy symptoms. That's nothing to sneeze at. A side note entitled Riding the Waves. The invention of the electroencephalogram, the EEG, to measure brainwave activity has been described as one of the most surprising, remarkable, and momentous developments in the history of clinical neurology. Scientists discovered that humans have 4 main mental states, 2 while sleeping and 2 while awake. Delta waves, in which your brain is electrically pulsing slowly at about 1 wave per second, typically only seen in deep sleep. Then there's theta wave sleep, about 5 cycles per second. This mental state occurs when you're dreaming. The 2 waking states are alpha and beta. The alpha state is relaxed, aware, and attentive, such as when you close your eyes and meditate. Beta, meanwhile, is the stimulated hustle and bustle state in which most of us live our lives. Alpha is where you want to be, fully alert and focused, yet calm. How do you get there? If you relax in a pleasant, peaceful place, after about 90 minutes you can start to generate some significant alpha activity, though such practicing meditators as Buddhist monks can achieve this state much earlier and maintain it even with their eyes open. To acquire this talent, you could meditate every day for a few years, or you could just drink some tea. Within minutes of tea consumption, anyone may be able to attain that same relaxed but alert brainwave pattern. That dramatic alteration in brain activity may explain why tea is the world's single most popular beverage after water. Both white and green teas are less processed than black tea, probably preferable. White tea is made from young leaves and is named after the silvery white hairs on the immature buds. Green tea is made from more mature leaves. Which tea is healthier? The answer seems to depend on whether or not you add lemon. If you drink your tea without lemon, green tea appears to be preferable to white tea, but if you add lemon, white tea jumps ahead. The reason may be that while there are more phytonutrients in white tea, they may only be released at a certain pH level. In terms of cancer prevention potential, both green and white teas have been shown to protect against DNA damage in vitro, against FIP, the cooked meat carcinogen I described earlier. White tea won out, though, blocking upwards of 100% of DNA damage compared to green tea, which at the same concentration only blocked about half. The potent anti-mutagenic effect of white tea in comparison with green tea was achieved at a brewing time of 1 minute. For most of the teas tested, steeping longer than 1 minute had no additional effect. In terms of antioxidant activity, though, it may be better not to brew at all. Cold steeping is a popular way to prepare tea in Taiwan, especially during the summer months. Cold steep tea is not like conventional iced tea in which you brew your tea hot and then cool it down. Rather, cold steeping involves tossing the tea in cold water and letting it sit at room temperature or in the fridge for at least 2 hours. This method has been found to reduce the caffeine content and said to reduce the bitterness and improve the aroma. But what does cold steeping do to the nutrient content? You would think that cold water wouldn't draw out as many antioxidants. After all, nutrient extraction is presumably the whole point of brewing tea with hot water, right? A group of scientists took it upon themselves to compare the antioxidant activity of hot versus cold steeped tea. Essentially, they mixed LDL, bad cholesterol, with free radicals and timed how long it took the cholesterol to oxidize in the presence of both hot and cold steeped tea. In a surprise upset, cold steeped white tea was significantly better at slowing down oxidation. No significant effect of brewing temperatures on the antioxidant activity of green tea was found. The researchers surmised that traditional tea water is so hot that it manages to destroy some of the more sensitive antioxidants in white tea. So I no longer brew my tea, I just let it sit overnight in the fridge. Cold steeping saves prep time and energy and may even be healthier. You don't have to care about how much nutrition is extracted from the tea leaves, though, if you simply eat them. Matcha is powdered green tea, produced by milling whole tea leaves into a fine powder that can be added straight to water. Why waste nutrition by dumping a tea bag when you're done, when you can drink the leaves instead? Think of it this way. Drinking steeped tea is akin to boiling a pot of collard greens and then throwing away the veggies and just drinking the cooking water. Sure, some of the nutrition leached into the water, but wouldn't it be better to eat the leaves themselves? That's why I now just throw whole tea leaves straight into my smoothies. This is also a great way to incorporate tea into your diet if drinking tea on an empty stomach causes discomfort. If you can develop a taste for matcha, I find it a little grassy tasting, but you can carry around these little packets of it wherever you go and just put some in your water bottle and shake. For essentially zero calories, you can drink dark green leafies all day. If green tea is so good, why not just take green tea extract pills? Because of dozens of reported cases of liver toxicity linked to their use, yet another demonstration that it's better to eat the whole food than some glorified active ingredient concentrate. There is one tea beverage I'd stay away from, though. Based on a few cases of serious life-threatening outcomes linked to kombucha tea, a type of fermented tea, the consumption of kombucha should be discouraged, according to one case report of a person who ended up in a coma after drinking the stuff. Are there any caveats to regular tea consumption? Well, the fluoride content of tea appears to be the limiting factor. The tea plant naturally concentrates fluoride from the soil, which is one of the reasons tea consumption may help fight cavities, but too much fluoride can be toxic. A recent case reported in the New England Journal of Medicine described a woman who started experiencing bone pain after 17 years of habitually consuming a pitcher of tea made from 100 to 150 tea bags daily. That's too much. To prevent skeletal fluorosis, adults should probably not drink more than about 20 tea bags worth of black tea a day for 20 years straight, or 30 bags of green tea daily, or 80 bags of white tea a day. To prevent dental fluorosis, a harmless but unsightly mottled tooth discoloration, children should probably refrain from drinking more than 3 bags of black tea a day, or around 4 bags of green or 12 of white, while their teeth are still developing up until around age 9. The best sweetener. Earlier I shared research suggesting that adding sugar may negate some of the benefits of beverages, while adding artificial sweeteners like aspartame or saccharin may make things even worse. Are there any health-promoting sweeteners? The only two concentrated green light sweeteners may be blackstrap molasses and date sugar. other natural caloric sweeteners such as honey, less processed cane sugars, and maple agave and brown rice syrups don't appear to have much to offer nutritionally. Date sugar is a whole food, just dried dates ground up into a powder, as are date and prune pastes, which can be homemade or purchased. These are all good options for baking, but for sweetened drinks, the taste of molasses may be too strong, and the whole food sweeteners don't fully dissolve. How about stevia? During the 1990s, research out of Japan found that steviosides, the so-called active ingredient of stevia, appeared harmless. But in the guts of rats, intestinal bacteria transformed steviosides into a toxic substance called steviol, which can cause a big spike in mutagenic DNA damage in vitro. Unfortunately, it turns out that humans have the same bacterial activity in their guts. It's the dose that makes the poison, though. The World Health Organization considers up to 1.8 milligrams of stevia compounds per pound of body weight to be a safe amount. Given the American sweet tooth, though, if we sweetened everything with stevia, we could exceed that safety limit. But just drinking up to 2 stevia-sweetened beverages a day should be considered harmless. The sugar alcohol, sorbitol, and xylitol are harmless in themselves, but they aren't absorbed by the body and end up in the colon, where they can draw in fluid and cause diarrhea. That's why they're only used commercially in small quantities, such as mints or chewing gum, as opposed to beverages. A related compound, however, erythritol, is absorbed and may have the harmlessness of xylitol without the laxative effect. Erythritol is found naturally in pears and grapes, but industrially yeast is used to produce it. Erythritol doesn't cause cavities, and it hasn't been implicated in fibromyalgia, preterm birth, headaches, hypertensive, brain disorders, platelet disorders, like other low-calorie sweeteners have been. Moreover, erythritol may actually have some antioxidant properties. As with any highly processed product, though, its utility should be confined to increasing your consumption of green light foods. So, for example, if the only way for you to eat half a grapefruit is to sprinkle some sugar on it, then it's probably better to eat a sugared grapefruit than no grapefruit at all, though sprinkling it with erythritol may be even healthier. With this logic in mind, I use erythritol to increase my consumption of cranberries, remember that pink juice recipe, cocoa powder, and hibiscus tea. A side note on my hibiscus punch. In 2010, an antioxidant analysis of 300 different beverages was published, examining everything from Red Bull to red wine. And the winner is hibiscus tea. I documented its potent antihypertensive effects earlier in the high blood pressure chapter. I've always had normal blood pressure by U.S. standards, but I wanted to shoot for optimal, so hibiscus became a daily staple. Give this recipe a try. To 8 cups of water, add a handful of dried bulk hibiscus, or 4 bags of tea in which hibiscus is the first ingredient. Then add the juice of 1 lemon and 3 tablespoons of erythritol, and leave it in your fridge to cold brew overnight. In the morning, strain out the hibiscus or take out the tea bags, shake well, and drink throughout the day. That's something I try to do every day I'm home. For extra credit, add green foam. Pour a cup of the tea into a blender with a bunch of fresh tea leaves, blend on high, and enjoy. You end up with dark green leafies blended into what may be the highest antioxidant beverage in the world, and it tastes like fruit punch. Your kids will love it. As with any sour food or beverage, though, make sure to rinse your mouth with water after consumption to prevent the natural acids from dissolving your enamel. Do not brush your teeth within an hour after eating or drinking something sour, as your enamel may be in a softened state and be further damaged by brushing. If you sip continuously throughout the day, I suggest using a straw to bypass your teeth. Be careful with sweeteners, though. There are 3 ways that even harmless sweeteners could theoretically be harmful. Over the years, numerous large-scale studies have found a correlation between artificial sweetener use and weight gain. The most common explanation for this counterintuitive finding is reverse causation. People aren't fat because they drink diet soda. They drink diet soda because they're fat. But there are at least 3 other less benign alternative explanations. The first is called overcompensation for expected caloric reduction. If you covertly switch people's soda for diet soda without them knowing it, their caloric consumption drops. This makes sense. They're not drinking all that sugar anymore. But what if you fess up to what you did? people who knowingly consume artificial sweeteners may actually end up eating more calories. They may figure after their zero-calorie drink they can, you know, indulge in that second piece of pie. Indeed, that's what studies have shown. For example, if you give subjects an aspartame-sweetened cereal for breakfast, but only inform half the participants that the sweetener was artificial, when lunchtime comes, the aspartame-informed group ends up eating significantly more than the aspartame-naive group. I think of this concept anytime I see someone at a fast food restaurant ordering, you know, a diet soda with their meal. A second explanation for gaining weight while using artificial sweeteners is based on how humankind evolved. When your brain registers the sensation of sweetness on your tongue, millions of years of evolution remind your brain to boost your appetite to eat as much as possible. After all, naturally sweet plant foods like fruits or sweet potatoes are among the healthiest. When you drink a can of diet soda, your brain thinks you just stumbled across a wild blueberry bush and sends urgent signals to eat large and eat fast before someone else gets wind of your bounty. At the same time, your body knows that if you eat too many calories, you might get too fat and not be able to outrun that saber-toothed tiger. So when your gut senses that you've absorbed enough calories, it sends signals up to your brain to urge you to stop eating. When you ingest low-calorie sweeteners, however, you experience the familiar hunger-boosting effect due to the sensation of sweetness on your tongue, yet you lack the hunger-suppressing effect of calories entering your gut. The result can be a revved-up appetite that can lead to eating more food than you otherwise would have. That's the second way diet soda could counterintuitively lead to weight gain. The third way involves maintaining cravings for and dependency on all things sweet. By continuing to consume any sweeteners, with or without calories, you're unable to train your flavor preferences away from intensely sweet foods. Let's say you use erythritol at home. That's great. But what happens when you go on vacation and don't have ready access to it? Your preference for intensely sweet food travels with you, and that may end up translating into the increased consumption of less than healthy foods. The bottom line? Erythritol seems safe, but only if you don't use it as an excuse to eat more junk food. With great sweetness comes great responsibility. Drink 5 glasses of water a day, be they plain tap water or flavored with fruit, tea leaves, or herbs. Keeping hydrated may elevate your mood and vigor, improve your thinking, and even help cut your risk of heart disease, bladder cancer, and other diseases. So, bottoms up.